The following is for your ears only. I'm David Alpern.
I'm Mark Garber, and we have newsmakers, experts, and top reporters to bring you these stories.
Pressing his disadvantage, Putin plays even tougher as evidence mounts of Russia's role in downing that plane over Ukraine. But the economic price mounts, too.
Losing the image war, Israel's bloody Gaza campaign may be reducing rocket attacks for now, but losing moral high ground. A rabbi's wife there comments.
Conflicting opinions from two federal courts over key Obamacare subsidies, from Democrats and the GOP over kid border crossers, women, and more.
A Philip farewell. Philip Seymour Hoffman's final film is a fittingly dark thriller from master spy writer John le Carré, plus Scarlett Johansson's Lucy and more.
Having a Ball, award-winning Broadway veteran George Ball finally releases his first CD with a little help from his singer-songwriter wife, Amanda McBroom.
Plus notable quotes from last week's news.
All that and more for your ears only, now a project of the nonprofit New York Foundation for the Arts. For your ears only, for the week of July 27th, I'm David Alpern.
And I'm Mark Garber with this quote from the news. We did not make this decision lightly. That was State Department spokeswoman Marie Harf on the evacuation of U.S. embassy personnel from Libya as militia fighting raged around the embassy building and airport in Tripoli, requiring a land convoy under the protection of two jet fighters and a drone tracker. Now this.
The state over which territory it happened is responsible for this terrible tragedy. There are calls for us to influence the militants. We will do everything in our power.
If Russia continues to violate Ukraine's sovereignty and to back these separatists, and these separatists become more and more dangerous and now are risks not simply to the people inside of Ukraine, but the broader international community, then Russia will only further isolate itself from the international community, and the costs for Russia's behavior will only continue to increase.
To judge by his public statements just a week apart, Russian President Vladimir Putin seemed to be moving away from his original denial of responsibility in the shootdown of that Malaysian jetliner over Ukraine. But while some observers wondered how much control he really had over pro-Russian separatists, whose passions and arsenal he had bolstered, the Obama administration last week charged Putin was actually stepping up support to reverse the militants' recent retreat under pressure from Ukraine's central government, sending in more heavy armament and, by some accounts, even permitting Russian firing across the border.
The European Union on Friday reached agreement on an outline of new economic sanctions on access to capital markets, arms, and high tech, although only going forward, which would permit completion of a controversial sale to Moscow of French helicopter carriers. And even if the EU should falter out of concern for its dependence on Russian energy, the marketplace itself was exacting a toll, $28 billion in lost stock value since the annexation of Crimea, even as stocks in the U.S. and elsewhere rose to all-time highs.
To consider these and related developments for your ears only, we turn again to Dr. Nina Khrushcheva, professor of international affairs at the New School University in New York. She's the great-granddaughter of the late Soviet Premier Nikita Khrushchev and author of The Lost Khrushchev, A Journey into the Gulag of the Russian Mind, from Tate Publishers in May. Welcome back to the program.
Thank you.
Are you surprised to see Putin escalating provocation and support for the separatists, even while the shame sort of builds around him?
Well, not really, unfortunately, because since the crisis began, every time when people say, well, this would be a good opportunity for Putin to back off because it's getting only worse, he actually doesn't take this opportunity. So this is just yet another succession of this kind of not taking an opportunity. The problem, of course, for Putin is that every single next crisis is worse than the previous one. And although originally I was very convinced that he doesn't want to be a pariah of the world, but he still wants to be important and recognized, now I'm not even sure that there is a turning back. I don't even know whether he would have an opportunity to continue to become, to be a partner of any country at this point, because if Holland turn away from him, that's really almost the beginning of the end.
Well, you say that the incompetence in Putin's Ukraine policy could eventually undermine his new popularity with the Russian people and support from top-level leaders. Talk about how that same dynamic played out three decades ago when the Soviet military downed a Korean Airlines passenger jet.
Well, that was my theory. I mean, history is only an indication. It doesn't have to be prescription. So when the Korean airline was downed by the Soviet military in 1983, the response was so discombobulated and so blatantly propagandistic that it was very difficult to really stay on course of what the Soviet Union was saying. And so that happened in 83, and at the time the Soviet Union was actually fluctuating between various geriatric leaders. And by 1985, Mikhail Gorbachev, who was a youngster, he was in his 50s. I mean, that was really unheard of in the late years of the Soviet Union. He came in to be the leader, and of course we know what happened next. There was not glasnost, perestroika, and ultimately the collapse of the Soviet Union or the whole communist formula around the world. So that's what my comparison is about. You know, the question is how weak Putin regime is, because in 1983 Soviet regime was very weak. Is it weak enough to really collapse quickly enough? Although, of course, there's no question that it is going to collapse reasonably soon, I believe.
Beyond the tragic plane shootdown in Ukraine and the economic toll of sanctions and risk-averse market forces, you say there's evidence of incompetence and corruption all around Putin's Russia. Give us some examples.
Well, there is. I mean, and you know, one of the interesting developments, or was an interesting development, that only a year ago, last summer, his approval rating was really not great. I mean, at some point it was at 48%, which is really unheard of. At the time, people were paying attention to what's happening around them. And for example, I mean, there are incredible instances of police corruption when, you know, somebody is being arrested for petty crimes, and then the bribe that the policeman is getting is 10 times more, 1,000 times more than the money that was sort of petty crime that was involved and whatnot. There's horrible situation on the roads because the road police also is monumentally corrupt. I mean, now it's all lost in big stories, but smaller stories that in various towns, the hospitals are burning or blowing up and whatnot. So there's no infrastructure really for the people to actually believe in the government to help them in their own personal lives. And that's my belief, is that when the grandiosity of what Putin is doing, standing up to the West, is gone, then people will start looking at their own lives and say, you know, we don't want this man. It's really become too disruptive and too impossible for us to go on with our lives.
You say it's unfair to blame your late great-grandfather for setting the stage for the current crisis by shifting Crimea to Ukraine while he was the Soviet leader. You've also projected what Khrushchev's reaction to Putin's retaking Crimea might be, based on what he said after Soviet tanks put down the 1968 Prague Spring in Czechoslovakia. Tell us about that.
Well, I mean, I know, I thought we already moved beyond Crimea, because now it seems like it was in a different century. Khrushchev would absolutely believe that the Soviet leader or the Kremlin leader has the right to stand his ground versus the menacing West, and sort of that was very communist belief, and Putin kind of upholds to that communist belief, although, of course, there's no communism. Khrushchev would not really be, I think, a great supporter of tanks, the way Putin has been dealing with the crisis in Ukraine, and certainly in East Ukraine. When the tanks, the Soviet tanks, once again went in to squash the Prague Spring, at the time, Khrushchev was very upset. He was already a pensioner. He had nothing to do with Soviet affairs. But what he said at home, he said, it has been 12 years and we haven't learned a better way. So my kind of citation of Khrushchev, what he would have said today, is that it has been 60 years and we haven't learned a better way, and there is no excuse for that.
Nina Khrushcheva is a professor of international affairs at the New School University in New York. She is the great-granddaughter of late Soviet Premier Nikita Khrushchev and author of The Lost Khrushchev, A Journey into the Gulag of the Russian Mind.
Quote from the news, "This is not the will of Iraqi people or the women of Iraq in these vulnerable areas." That was UN humanitarian coordinator in Iraq Jacqueline Badcock on reports that the militant group Islamic State had ordered all girls and women in and around the northern city of Mosul to undergo female genital mutilation.
Next, from David to Goliath, for your ears only. We're back for Your Ears Only. I'm Mark Garber.
I'm David Alpern with this quote from the news. A comprehensive condemnation of the CIA, the Black Site program, and Poland's role in it. That was Joseph Margulies, lawyer for one of two terrorism suspects, after the European Court of Human Rights ruled against Poland for allowing their transfer to a secret CIA site for torture. It was the first such case of European complicity the court has taken up. Now this.
I don't know what happened. We were sleeping. Our house completely collapsed on us.
It's morally wrong to kill your own people. Whole world has been watching, is watching with great concern. You must stop fighting and enter into dialogue.
Sirens over Tel Aviv, the survivor of a bombing in Gaza, and UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon after the attack on a UN school that killed at least 15 Palestinians sheltering there, many of them children. With the death toll among Palestinians approaching 1,000 compared with 35 Israelis, much of the media coverage began to suggest overkill on the part of Benjamin Netanyahu's government.
Rejecting the urgent plea from U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry for a week-long humanitarian ceasefire, Jerusalem did announce a 12-hour lull during which it would continue its search-and-destroy campaign against Hamas tunnels into Israel. For an on-scene view of the situation for Your Ears Only, we turn to Dassey Berkowitz, an American Jewish educator and program director, recently relocated to Jerusalem with her husband, Rabbi Leon Morris, and three young children. Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
When did you and your family arrive in Israel?
So we arrived just a month ago, and it was right around the time that the three teenage boys were kidnapped, Naftali, Gilad, and Ayal. And you know, things were tense here. When we arrived, a friend of mine commented that, you know, things are tense, please bring some joy. So we're very happy to do that. You know, this is a big change for our family and really a dream of ours to make the Jewish homeland our home. And so we were full of energy when we first arrived. And I think what we sensed immediately was really the solidarity among Israelis.
How has the conflict affected the lives of your husband, your children, and yourself?
So we've had three sirens in Jerusalem, and thank God for the Iron Dome missile defense system, which has been amazing at really defending against any major damage, certainly here in Jerusalem. You know, the South has been a little bit stronger hit, but one of the most startling of the sirens was on a Saturday afternoon, a Shabbat afternoon, when we were having a picnic lunch, and all of a sudden the siren went off, and we quickly took shelter in a neighboring apartment building. And what was amazing was, you know, a woman from the building who came and was at the door and saw us running with our children and beckoned us in, and we all kind of hung out in the shelter. All Israeli apartment buildings are built with miklatim or bomb shelters, because sadly this happens too often. But we try to normalize it as much as we can. You know, singing the Itsy Bitsy Spider calms tensions. And I think when you're a parent, you realize that when you have the responsibility for calming your kids, it enables you to really calm yourself.
You write about peace marches and joining gestures of Jewish-Arab unity, but also about the needs of the hour as Israel's armed forces target tunnels, the rocket arsenals, and launching capabilities of Hamas. Do you see this military goal being achieved on a permanent basis, or at least for a substantial period of time, or just in the cyclical way the conflict has surged and subsided for years?
You know, sadly, there is really a cycle of violence here, and I was speaking to a rabbi here, Tamar Elad Applebaum, who said, you know, there's a cycle of violence, and then, but what we really need is visionary leadership and even regular civilians who can have faith and kind of jump beyond the cycle and see the bigger picture. So I think that, you know, I think this isn't going to end the conflict and the conflict in the Middle East. I would hate to say that it's a permanent one. You know, the faith side of me says that there will be peace one day, but I think it takes a lot of smart people to think creatively and to really dream big to make that happen.
You also write of the smart, talented, educated people of Gaza you met during a more hopeful period and wish they had produced the kind of Palestinian leadership that values state building and civil society. The suggestion seems to be that they could have created a firewall against Hamas extremism. But the critics say such leaders could not succeed because Israeli policies precluded the kind of economic and social development that might eventually have rallied the so-called Arab street.
So, you know, I think I would look back to 9 years ago when Israel evacuated Gaza and we left agricultural industry and other industries there. And, you know, our goal, you know, it's a small neighborhood. Our goal is really to have Gaza thrive socially, economically, politically, with a peaceful Gaza. Israel can thrive. You know, there would be could be a ton of commerce going back and forth. You know, this was Shimon Peres's dream of the Middle East and the new Middle East. So, you know, I'm an optimist. I'm not a pessimist. And I think that there certainly is a sense of radicalism that, you know, that has led to the popularity of Hamas. But I don't think that those are the only voices. You know, I think that there are plenty of people who want to live good, happy lives and provide for their children and their families and would be willing to do so, but they're shouted out by extremist elements.
Even some Jewish critics of the Netanyahu government say it has already lost the war for international public opinion. The number of fatal accidents, if that's what they really were, is growing daily, and the toll of civilian Palestinian dead and wounded is just so much greater than that on the Israeli side. Do you fear that the image of Israel as underdog David is morphing into that of a cruel giant Goliath?
You know, I think that public opinion, you know, I think the news and the media is so quick, you know, now, and pictures paint 1,000 words, 100%. But I think we really need to be attuned to nuance and listening and hearing. And if you're only hearing one story, to listen for more and more stories, I think, on both sides. I think the loss of life is tragic. But I also think that we need to remember that the Israeli army is, this isn't a war that they're looking for. The Israeli army has done what it can to try to get the, to warn civilians to evacuate their homes. So I think that we really need to be careful of what we're listening to and hearing. We need to remember that, you know, Israeli values are American values, due process, you know, certainly things go wrong in the IDF and not everything is, you know, picture perfect, and that those incidents are reported and they are evaluated and, you know, and that there's, you know, due process, freedom of press, all of that. So I think that before we're so quick, you know, of lambasting Israel for being the giant Goliath, I think we need to be more attuned. But I mean, it pains me as a mother, you know, to but there is so much loss of life. And we, you know, please God, pray for the end of this conflict and the ceasefire very soon.
Dazi Berkowitz is an American Jewish educator and program director, recently relocated to Jerusalem with her husband, Rabbi Leon Morris, and 3 young children.
Quote from the news, "We're lucky they just put flags up there and not a bomb." That was a New York City law enforcement official after the discovery that 2 giant American flags on the Brooklyn Bridge had been replaced unnoticed one night with bleached white banners as a prank or a comment on national cowardice.
Next, another blow to Obamacare and other domestic developments. For your ears only.
We're back for Your Ears Only. I'm David Alpern.
And I'm Mark Garber with this quote from the news. "This was my first execution, and I was surprised by how peaceful it was." That was Stephanie Grisham, a spokeswoman for Arizona Attorney General Tom Horn, after what other observers called a nearly 2-hour wheezing, gasping, lethal injection death sentence gone wrong. There is growing pressure for Supreme Court review of the process. Now this.
While this ruling is interesting to legal theorists, it has no practical impact on their tax credits right now. You don't need a fancy legal degree to understand that Congress intended for every eligible American to have access to tax credits that would lower their health care costs.
White House Press Secretary Josh Earnest last week brushed aside the notion that millions of Americans enrolled in Obamacare on the federal exchange would lose tax subsidies because of a federal appeals court ruling. It held that such breaks are available only through state exchanges. Not long after, a different federal appeals court issued a contradictory ruling, making it likely the issue eventually will come to the U.S. Supreme Court. But GOP critics of the president didn't wait to cheer the beginning of the end of his health care reform.
They also continued to flay the president for excessive executive action on other aspects of Obamacare and unrelated domestic issues, and excessive passivity when it comes to foreign crises, from Syria to Gaza to Ukraine. To consider the political implications of all these issues and more, for your ears only, we're joined again by David Mark, editor-in-chief of the interactive political news and discussion site Politics. He's also the author of Going Dirty, The Art of Negative Campaigning, and co-author of Dog Whistles, Walkbacks, and Washington Handshakes, Decoding the Jargon, Slang, and Bluster of American Political Speech, out next month. Welcome back to the program.
My pleasure. Happy to be here.
Let's begin with Obamacare. Polls still show it to be widely unpopular, but are there enough folks now enrolled and benefiting to make it difficult for politicians to kill, if not the Supreme Court? Will it be dangerous for Republicans to run against in too many places?
Yeah, I think polling, while it does show the Affordable Care Act to be unpopular, its overall popularity is rising in the polls slowly but surely, particularly when people hear about specific provisions of it, whether it's being able to young people being able to keep on their parents' health programs through age 26, some of the subsidies, some of the other issues. So I don't think you even hear Republicans trying to run it, kind of repeal it as much as maybe going after other specific provisions that aren't working so well. So bottom line, people are getting more used to it and liking it more.
The controversy over Central American kids crossing our southern border illegally also has political implications, with Republican Texas Governor Perry mobilizing the National Guard, though the refugees actually come to surrender. Does his handling of the issue help rehabilitate his presidential prospect?
It has the potential to. It certainly shows Governor Perry to be more in charge, like he's taking executive action. Of course, he has quite limited powers here. He can't really deal with immigration issues, which is the crux of the matter, whether or not they're deported, whether the Immigration Naturalization Service allows them to stay or go or has deportation hearings. But it certainly shows Governor Perry to have taken charge of an issue and not kind of be wishy-washy and forgetful the way he came off in the 2012 Republican presidential primaries.
Well, some analysts still expect some movement in Congress on immigration, though likely less on reform than redoubling enforcement, maybe trying to rewrite the law President Bush signed to provide refugee proceedings for Central Americans escaping violence. Do you agree?
Absolutely. I think there's going to be forced action. It's, as you suggest, it's not likely to be the grand, sweeping immigration-type law along the lines of what President Reagan signed into law in 1986 and what had been discussed for several years now. But members of Congress on both sides of the aisle have compelling reasons to deal with this border crisis. President Obama has asked for nearly $4 billion in aid to try and secure the border and deal with deportations. Republicans in Congress want less, but I think there'll be some kind of agreement, if only to end the urgency of the current crisis.
Despite the drama on borders here in Gaza and Ukraine, Obama has kept up a steady schedule of fundraiser. Does the president lose stature by doing that, or is he helping to fill Democratic coffers the best way he can, given the fact that his own approval rating is so sinking?
Right. That's certainly the argument that the Democrats make, even if they don't talk about his unpopularity. They suggest that he can do his job just fine remotely, like President George W. Bush did from his ranch in Crawford, Texas, for a considerable amount of time. And they also argue that a lot of the criticism is really aimed at preventing President Obama from doing his job as president. And the White House is pushing back pretty hard on this, saying, you know what, there's satellite communications equipment available. There's no reason that President Obama is not fully engaged when he's on the road.
Going back to the Republican side, Paul Ryan has made an interesting proposal for reforming federal social spending. Rand Paul is making a more direct approach to African-American voters. Talk about that.
Right. They both are taking kind of unorthodox routes, you might say, for Republicans in Congress. Congressman Ryan's proposal is the more controversial of the two among African-American voters. He's talking about basically reforming welfare programs, a spate of welfare programs to make them block grants, allow states to oversee them. This has some support among governors, but a lot of people say if you start doing that, then the federal government will eventually reduce its overall spending and it will do more harm than good. Obviously a very debatable notion. Rand Paul is making a more explicit outreach approach to African-American voters. He's talking about reining in some of the rules in southern states to restrict voting rights, to tighten voting rules, also to allow felons to vote, former felons, which is a pretty controversial notion.
A newly released NBC Marist poll illustrates the Democratic Party's gender gap. It's with women voters. In the U.S. Senate race in Colorado, incumbent Democrat Mark Udall is up by 12 points among female voters, 50% to 38%, as Democratic groups like Senate Majority PAC are running TV ads focusing on abortion and contraception. How important do you see the gender gap to be in this year's midterms and in 2016?
I think it's absolutely huge, and that's one of the reasons Democrats are focusing so intently on issues like contraception coverage, abortion, these kind of wedge social issues, because particularly women, single women, are a deal-breaker constituency in this election. You could argue that President Obama secured re-election through the help of single women in states like Colorado, Virginia, Florida, and elsewhere, and we're seeing continued focus on that, and I think we're going to hear it amped up even more in the coming months up to Election Day.
David Mark is editor-in-chief of the interactive political news and discussion site Politics. He's also the author of Going Dirty, The Art of Negative Campaigning, and co-author of Dog Whistles, Walkbacks, and Washington Handshakes, Decoding the Jargon, Slang, and Bluster of American Political Speech, out next month.
Quote from the news, I'm very happy I was doing it when I was doing it. I'm very happy now I'm not doing it. That was a comment on Congress by former Democratic House member Barney Frank back on Capitol Hill briefly to testify on finance reform.
Next, Philip Seymour Hoffman's fine film farewell, for your ears only. We're back for Your Ears Only. I'm Mark Garber.
I'm David Alpern with this quote from the news. She says, don't shoot me. I'm pregnant. I'm going to have a baby. And I shot her anyway. That was 80-year-old Long Beach, California retiree Tom Greer after killing one of two would-be burglars he struggled with and then chased out with his .22 pistol. The woman turned out not to be pregnant, but as she was already outside and fleeing when shot, Greer could be open to criminal charges. Now this.
We're here because German intelligence needs a job done that German law won't let it do.
Every good man has a little bit of bad, doesn't he? But that little bit just might kill you.
There's no going back for any of us.
Philip Seymour Hoffman's film finale, the new dramatization of John le Carré's typically dark and morally murky intelligence thriller, A Most Wanted Man. With that line of dialogue by Robin Wright that can't help make you think of the super-talented Hoffman's fatal drug overdose earlier this year. To talk about his farewell performance, the film itself, and other recent releases, we're joined again by Boston Globe film critic Ty Burr. His books include Gods Like Us, On Movie Stardom and Modern Fame, and The Best 100 Movies of All Time. Welcome back to the program.
Thanks.
Le Carré himself recently wrote about being in awe of Hoffman on the movie set. What most impressed you about his final performance and what it hinted his future as an actor might have been?
You know, this performance is of a piece with pretty much everything he did. He never showboats. You never get the sense that he's playing to an audience out there. He's drawing an audience in. The character he plays is a German intelligence expert who's sort of at the end of the road, is in lousy shape, smokes too much, is disliked by everybody else in the intelligence community precisely because he's actually got a code of honor. And he is so burnt out at this point. You know, Hoffman, for better and for worse, was very good at playing wrecks, moral wrecks and physical wrecks. And, you know, it's funny to see him in this movie where he really is kind of out of breath and just drinking too much and smoking. And then you'll see him in an interview on the set, and he looks pretty together. I stress that it was acting. He was an actor, and he was really terrific at it. But he could draw you into these people that are struggling in life and almost remind you how much we all sort of struggle in life.
You propose a new category of Oscar for a star of the latest Planet of the Apes vehicle, Dawn of, Best Motion Picture Capture Performance. Talk about the technology involved and how Andy Serkis matches it with subtle emotion.
Well, you know, I'm not an expert on the technology, but basically it involves an actor in a, you know, studio covered with green wall covering, I believe, and their body is, and face are covered with these all these little electronic post-its, basically, that are sending information to computer so that when an actor raises an eyebrow, that goes to the computer. I mean, when they move around the room, that goes to the computer. And they can then take all that data, and it's a ton of data, and clothe the performance in whatever they want. So you get the creatures of Avatar, you get Gollum of The Lord of the Rings, you get in the new Planet of the Apes series, you get, you know, the apes. And Gollum and the apes and King Kong and Peter Jackson's King Kong are all played by the same person, Andy Serkis. And the funny thing about this movie is that the apes, the CGI digital apes, are more involving or more emotionally expressive than the human actors in the film. And that's that says where our technology has gone, and is also a little worrisome. But Andy Serkis, I think, he does give real performances with his body language and with his expressiveness, even though you're not actually seeing his face. You're seeing the record of his expressiveness. It's very weird, and I'm kind of kidding when I say that it should be given an Oscar, but it should be talked about and honored in some way. He's doing something special.
You say Scarlett Johansson does remarkable work in a semi-familiar sci-fi trope, man becomes God, or in this case, woman, as Lucy. Talk about how well she reflects the self-consciousness of growing paranormal power she gains in a drug accident.
Well, in Lucy, Scarlett Johansson plays a young woman, not terribly bright, who, through a plot twist I can't go into here, it's just too complicated, her brain accesses all 100% of its potential. It's that old canard. It's not really true, but there have been other movies made on that subject. In this case, her character, by the time she's able to access 50%, she's moving furniture around with her mind. She's accessing other people's, you know, cell data through by plucking it out of the air, and it keeps on going. This is an action thriller, very stylish, completely ridiculous, but a lot of fun, written and directed by Luc Besson, who made La Femme Nikita, and he sort of specializes in these over-the-top action movies with strong women. And Scarlett Johansson is just doing interesting things in her career between her, in which she played this sentient computer operating system that takes over the world, and Under the Skin, this midnight movie where she's this odd alien, and now this, where she really, by the end of the movie, she is omnipresent, omniscient. She is, for all intents and purposes, God, and we're not worthy.
Talk about the experimental filmmaking process that produced Richard Linklater's Boyhood, just a few days every year for a dozen years to roll out a fictional coming-of-age story.
Yeah, well, Linklater and his cast really rolled the dice on this. They just started making this, you know, movie, well, it's 12 years in the making, and it was about 14 years ago when they started. They just, you know, had a six-year-old kid and an actress and an actor playing the parents, and the director's daughter playing the older sister, and they filmed for a couple of days, and then they came back every year, and they still didn't know what the end result was going to be, because they didn't know how the kid was going to turn out, what he was going to grow up to be. And the actor, Eller Coltrane's young man, luckily he grew up into a really remarkable man, and the special thing about the movie is that you see this aging process, not just him, but the parents and everybody around him and the culture.
Finally, talk about the documentary on the life and death of film critic Roger Ebert, Life Itself. What does the film tell us about Ebert, how he loved the movies, how he helped change the way we all came to love movies?
The movie, directed by Steve James, who made Hoop Dreams, with Ebert's input, it's a wonderful story about a newspaper man, and it covers the scope of his career and the struggles he had in his career and difficulties he had with other people and with alcohol. And it's not a, you know, angelic portrait, but it is a true portrait, also of the changes that movies went through in the 60s, 70s, 80s, and beyond. And it's also a portrait of a couple, because Chaz Ebert, Roger Ebert's wife, is a very important part of the film and the filmmaking. Their relationship, as they are tested by this unimaginable physical hardship that he went through before his death. So there's a lot in this movie. It's not about a movie critic. It's about a person, but a very expressive person. And it's a tremendously moving film, even if you don't care about movie critics or even movies.
Boston Globe film critic Ty Burr. His books include Gods Like Us, On Movie Stardom and Modern Fame, and the best 100 movies of all time.
Quote from the news, they were less motivated by the fear of dying than the fear of suffering, of disability, of disfigurement. That was CDC Dr. Tom McAfee on a study that has led to a new wave of hard-to-watch TV spots showing the ravages of cancer caused by smoking.
Next, a new CD, Years in the Making, and a family affair for your ears only.
A last chorus for your ears only. I'm David Alpern.
And I'm Mark Garber with this quote from the news. Trivia in triplicate. That's what the writer Bell Kaufman called the fictionalized public school memos that helped make her debut novel Up the Down Staircase so hilarious and successful. A granddaughter of the Yiddish writer Shalom Aleichem, or Fiddler on the Roof fame, Kaufman died last week at age 103. Now this.
So this is finally love. So this is what I spent my whole life searching for. Someone I could call my home. Someone who is always there. A light in the dark. A welcoming heart.
When Love Grows Up is one of several songs of age and wisdom on the new CD Think of Me by award-winning stage and screen performer George Ball. Known for on- and off-Broadway roles in Sweeney Todd, Jacques Brel Is Alive and Well, and Living in Paris, among other shows, and TV series, including General Hospital and Santa Barbara. His first solo release, Think of Me, is also something of a family affair. Words and music for When Love Grows Up were written by his singer-songwriter wife of 43 years, former guest Amanda McBroom, who also supplies backup vocal on another track.
The CD itself was co-produced by McBroom's frequent concert and cabaret musical director, Michelle Brewerman, who also provided arrangements, piano, and keyboard. Ball, Brewerman, and McBroom appear this week at the Catalina Jazz Club in Hollywood, then again on October 8th and 14th at the 54 Below Supper Club in New York City. And to talk more about how it all came together after so many years, George Ball and Amanda McBroom are on the line now. Welcome to our show.
Thank you.
George, where did you grow up, and how did you first get into acting and singing?
I grew up in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, and I was a singer from the time I was a little kid. But I got interested in the theater when I was in high school, and you know, I got the lead in the class musical and so on and so forth. And then I became involved in the Pittsburgh entertainment scene. And one day someone called me and said the Playhouse, Pittsburgh Playhouse, which was pretty famous at that time, was looking for someone to play Miles Gloriosus, and a funny thing happened on the way to the Forum. So that was my first professional job.
I know from an earlier interview with Amanda that she also appeared in a production of Jacques Brel. Is that where you met?
That is where we met, yeah, in San Francisco.
Were you merely one another's fans for some time after you met, or as you sing in Some Enchanted Evening, did somehow you know even then that you'd see her again and again?
Met her. She came to see the show. She was an actress from. She was working up in Ashland, Oregon, and she came backstage. And I thought she was so attractive that I said, "Hey, if you want to see this again, give me a call." And I gave her my number, and she did call me, and she came and saw it a few times. And then one afternoon, the producer said to me, "Listen, we're losing Betty Rhodes, and I'm going to audition some girls this afternoon. Will you come and sit on the auditions?" And I said, sure. And the first person to walk out to audition was Amanda. I had no idea she was a singer.
Put Amanda on the line. I'd like to hear what her recollection is of that first meeting.
Exactly the same way. Well, actually, I saw him before he saw me, because I was sitting in the fourth row center when he and Bob Guillaume walked out and started to sing. And I just wanted to crawl right down his vocal cords the minute I heard it. I mean, I love a rich man's voice, and then when it came in such a handsome package, and he was such an astonishing singer, and it was such sexy material, and it was life changing as far as music. I'd never heard music like that, and I'd never heard anybody sing like that, and so it seemed I had to go backstage and afterwards and tell him so, and then I became a huge fan, and then I wound up auditioning for the show.
And I know you two performed together in Sondheim, Sweeney Todd, and A Little Night Music. Does working with a spouse make a show more complicated or more enjoyable?
Well, you know, when you're working with someone as good as him, it's wonderful on a professional level, and doing night music with him was bliss. because, you know, spending, you know, days in three-quarter time, your heart could not be happier. But when we did Sweeney, and George, I think, is the best Sweeney Todd that's ever been, I had to keep telling him, do not bring him home with you.
George, you write on the CD jacket that it took years of persuasion by Amanda and Michelle Brourman to get you to make one. Why the wait?
You know, it just wasn't my bailiwick. My thing was theater. Amanda had done, you know, she has her own record company, and she had done, and she's a, you know, as you well know, she's probably the best lyricist in the world. And I just felt like that wasn't my turf, so to speak. But the more I started to think about it, the more I sort of gave in, you know, and I went into the studio and I started recording, and then I brought the stuff home the first day, and I went, oh, this is awful.
The first batch of songs were things from shows you'd done, and what was the organizing principle of the selections that finally ended up on the CD?
It was about, you know, where I am in my life and what I wanted to say, what I felt about life and love, pretty much. A couple of my male friends have said that the album is courageous. I don't think it's courageous, but they sort of feel that way, that I make myself vulnerable.
Stage and screen veteran George Ball's first solo CD is Think of Me, out now from LML Music on iTunes, Amazon, and other retailers. Ball, wife Amanda McBroom, and music director Michelle Brourman perform at 8:30 this Tuesday evening, July 29th, at the Catalina Jazz Club on Sunset Boulevard in Hollywood, and on October 8th and 14th at the 54 Below Supper Club in New York.
These golden years I'll spend with you.
From September Song, and this has been For Your Ears Only. For Your Ears Only on air is also online at iTunes, FeedBurner.com, Stitcher.com, and going back years now at archive.org.
This broadcast was engineered by Justin Ewan at the Hangar Studio Playhead Productions. I'm Mark Garber.
I'm David Alpern. Our show is a nonprofit project of the New York Foundation for the Arts, supported by the Gatewave.org radio reading service for those with disabilities, the Best Memorial Trust, and award-winning ACAM Associates. Exceptional management, impeccable reputation for New York co-ops, condos, and condops since 1983. Learn more at ACAM.com. Pledge your tax-deductible donation to davideearsonly@gmail.com.
Now we're back with another archive segment, a major story on our show a year ago.
This week last year, we looked at the rising cost of health care through the eyes of doctors in a major survey of their views from our July 28, 2013 broadcast hosted by Eddie Robinson and me.
Mr. Speaker, I despise Obamacare. Just about everybody in America knows that. I think it should be ripped out by the roots. The minority of the Supreme Court, the clear-thinking constitutionalists, though, agree with me.
Just about everybody in America does know what Iowa's Republican Congressman Steve King thinks about Obamacare when he's not infuriating party leaders with unflattering comments about undocumented immigrants. Indeed, most politicians have taken a stand on the president's approach to expanding health care coverage and containing costs. Many major institutions also have chosen sides: hospitals, pharmaceutical, and insurance companies. Less well known are the views of those actually on the front line of medicine, doctors themselves.
There was a bit of light last week from a new survey in the Journal of the American Medical Association, but the findings were disappointing to many, even inside the medical profession. Majorities of more than 2,000 physicians surveyed by Mayo Clinic Dr. John C. Tilbert and colleagues did acknowledge that rising cost was a key concern in American medicine today. but just over a third thought that doctors themselves bore major responsibility to control that cost. The survey was analyzed in a JAMA editorial by Dr. Ezekiel J. Emanuel of the Department of Medical Ethics and Health Policy at the University of Pennsylvania's Wharton School. And for your ears only, Dr. Emanuel joins us now. Welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
Let's start with the good news. Talk about the degree to which doctors these days agree that cost must be a factor considered in the practice of medicine and whether you think it's changed from an earlier era.
Oh, it's definitely changed just over the course of my, from being a medical student and an intern and resident to now. Definitely doctors used to think, I know that the hospital I trained at, the Beth Israel in Boston, we had a chairman of medicine who said, you know, money should never come into consideration. It's never looking at value, looking at what you're going to get for the cost should never be a consideration. You're only advocating for your patient. And now you have not only doctors recognizing that cost is a problem, but you have leading professional medical organizations from the AMA to others saying, you know, we have a social responsibility, and part of that entails working on the cost issue. So I think that's a major, major change over just the last 20 to 30 years. And I think recognizing that, you know, costs are a big factor in America is an important move forward.
You write about doctors as captains of the healthcare ship. Remind us just how big a role they do play in deciding which patients get what tests, treatments, continuing care.
Well, it's been estimated about 85% of the healthcare dollar is a result of what doctors order, whether a test or a treatment or seeing another doctor. They are the captains of the ship. But, you know, with being the captain of the ship comes certain responsibilities.
Well, given all the decisions they guide, who do doctors think has more responsibility to control costs than they do?
Just about everyone else. Insurance companies, drug companies, government, patients. So, I think it's a bit of I want to be the captain, but I think that everyone else is responsible. That's not the way. First of all, it's not the way doctors would like their leaders to behave. They think that if you're going to be the leader, you got to take responsibility and you got to walk the walk. And I think, you know, they just need to reflect back on their own situation. And I think, you know, that's I think the bad news. The good or the sympathetic understanding is, look, it's pretty hard for them in the current circumstance. There's a lot of uncertainty going forward. They don't feel like the doctor situation is being well appreciated either by policymakers, by insurers, by hospitals necessarily. And they're feeling buffeted by the various demands on them without clear direction.
Well, let's talk about some of those changes. The survey shows significantly lower support among doctors for reforms that have a better prospects for really controlling costs, like abandoning classic fee-for-service compensation, some others, penalizing physicians for avoidable hospital readmissions. In other words, if you haven't really effected a cure, you ought to pay some price for it.
No, it's not that if you haven't effected a cure. If you've treated a patient, you send them out, and they're bounced back in 30 days, and that was a preventable situation by doing better follow-up, et cetera, then you should be penalized, not just any bounce back. So you have to be a little clear. But I think the bigger picture is, doctors practice currently practice in fee-for-service world. They understand that world at least to some degree. They may not like it, and I certainly know a lot of docs who don't like it. But changing off of it means you got to redo your business plan, you got to change how you practice, and that's a big, big lift. And so I think under those conditions, like most of us, they become conservative and say, oh, I don't want to change that, it's too much of an effort. Well, sorry, but almost every expert in the field will say changing how we pay doctors is necessary, even if alone it's not enough. It's an absolutely necessary component of shifting and bending the cost curve and getting costs under control.
Did the survey do enough breakouts by age to tell whether younger generations of physicians are more open to the kind of reforms, the sharing of responsibility, team approaches, using best practices based on real evidence than the older generation? Are you seeing changing attitudes of that sort?
I think the bigger, more interesting one is that the doctors who practice under salary and don't actually make more money for doing more are more open to these kind of payment reforms. That, I think, is the big, probably the most important piece of news there, in that how they were paid and their sort of familiarity. And this goes back to things we know from sort of psychology and behavioral economics. You know, you're more comfortable with things you're familiar with, and to the extent that doctors are familiar with being paid a salary and comfortable with it, they are more supportive of these payment changes.
Dr. Ezekiel J. Emanuel, the Department of Medical Ethics and Health Policy at the University of Pennsylvania's Wharton School. He wrote an editorial for the Journal of the American Medical Association about its survey of physician views of healthcare costs.
Doctors diagnose healthcare costs from a July 28, 2013 broadcast. We should have noted then that Dr. Emanuel has a special connection to the issue in general and Obamacare in particular, as a brother of Rahm Emanuel, former White House chief of staff, now mayor of Chicago. Earlier this month, the latest Congressional Budget Office report projected a slowing of the increase in federal spending on major health programs from 4.9% annually in 2014 to 7.5% in 2035, about 2.2 percentage points less than projected 5 years earlier. The growth in projected Medicare expenses was about 2.6 points lower than previous estimates.
This coming October, we'll see a major conference arranged by the American College of Lifestyle Medicine to consider how individual Americans, their insurers, and the government can save more millions through more personal responsibility for the kind of diet, exercise, and other activities that minimize many chronic and costly medical problems. I'm Mark Garber.
I'm David Alpern. We'll visit the archive again next week. Now, more of George Ball from his new Think of Me CD.
When I was a young man courting the girls, I played me a waiting game. If a maid refused me with tossing curls, I let the old earth take a couple of whirls while I plied her with tears in lieu of pearls. And as time came around, she came my way. As time came around, she came. When you meet with the young girls early in the spring, they court you with song and rhyme. They woo you with words in a clover ring. But if you examine the goods they bring, they have little to offer but the songs they sing, and a plentiful waste of the time of day, a plentiful waste of time. But it's a long, long while from May to December, and the days grow short when you reach September, and the autumn weather turns the leaves to flame. One hasn't got time for the waiting game. Oh, the days dwindle down to a precious few. September, November, and these few precious days I'll spend with you. These precious days I'll spend with you. Oh, the wine dwindles down to a vintage brew. September, November. And these few vintage years I'll share with you. These golden years I'll spend